You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Our passage today is from Luke's account of the early church we call Acts. While it's clear that Luke copied liberally from Mark and other sources to create his gospel, we're not sure where he got his material for Acts. When we compare some of the events Luke describes with Paul's writings from, say, 40 years earlier, it's clear that we have to take what Luke reports with a grain of salt. As a creative historian, Luke seems to have had no qualms about fabricating stories that, even if they hadn't actually happened, in his mind, should have happened. Our story today is probably one of those episodes. Luke reports that the apostles have been stirring up trouble in Jerusalem by preaching about dreams and visions, signs in the sky, coming miracles, and upsetting the religious status quo in general. So whether or not the apostles were actually dragged in front of the Sanhedrin, Jerusalem's council of ruling elites, is up for debate. But telling the story this way definitely provides a succinct way of capturing the very real tensions that were being felt in Jerusalem and elsewhere between the established Jewish norm and this upstart group of messianic fanatics. Right before our passage, Peter gives a brief but incendiary sermon where he basically tells the Sanhedrin, "Look, you guys unalived Jesus, but God made Jesus alive. God is doing something new here, and you guys are on the wrong side of the story." Well, as you can guess, mayhem ensues, and the Sanhedrin wants to take immediate action. So let's join our story as Peter and the apostles are about to be unceremoniously dealt with.
Our words of wisdom are from Acts chapter 5, verses 33 through 39. The Sanhedrin was furious and wanted to put the apostles to death. But a Pharisee named Gamaliel, a teacher of the law, who was honored by all the people, stood up in the Sanhedrin and ordered that the men be put outside for a little while. Then he addressed the Sanhedrin.
"Men of Israel, consider carefully what you intend to do with these men. Some time ago, Theudas appeared claiming to be a somebody, and about 400 men rallied to him. He was killed. All his followers were dispersed, and it all came to nothing. After him, Judas the Galilean appeared in the days of the census and led a band of people in revolt. He too was killed, and all his followers were scattered. Therefore, in the present case, I advise you, leave these men alone. Let them go. For if their purpose or activity is of human origin, it will fail. But if it is from God, you will not be able to stop these men. You will only find yourselves fighting against God."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
When I first read Harry Emerson Fosdick's Shall the Fundamentalist Win, it changed my life. In disbelief, I read portions of it over and over again. I looked at the date, I read it again, and thought, what? How in the world could he have preached this in 1922 and it still be controversial? Why hasn't this message gotten out? It was obvious to me as a young pastor that many of the people I was interacting with would still find what Fosdick was suggesting to be heretical and unchristian. And yet, what he was preaching has been taught in our seminaries for nearly 150 years. I learned it in seminary, and so did every other mainline and Roman Catholic seminary student. So how could this be? The short answer is, because the fundamentalists have won in many ways. They've managed to stake out a very particular and unchanging set of beliefs that they believe must never be questioned and must be defended at all costs. And with their appeal to the status quo and what they believe is the unchanging truth of God, they've managed to convince the vast majority of Christians that theirs is the only authentic and acceptable way to be a Christian. Meanwhile, those of us in more mainline traditions, steeped in the values of inclusion and tolerance, have said, fine, believe what you want. No skin off my nose. But by being inclusive and tolerant, we've made space for fundamentalists who hate inclusivity and tolerance to get a foothold in our churches and work to discredit the very values that we embrace. So while we've been going on our merry way with an evolving faith, embracing the realities of cultural change and progress, fundamentalists have continued to promote a static, unchanging slate of archaic doctrines and tell their people, you are to believe what we tell you to believe, no questions asked. But before I get ahead of myself, let's go back a few years for some context. Back in the early to mid 19th century, German theologians began reading the Bible in new ways. A theologian named David Friedrich Strauss analyzed the Gospels and developed the idea of what we now know as the historical Jesus, namely, that the Jesus portrayed in the Gospels was enhanced by the Gospel writers to portray Jesus as a divine God-man. But with careful analysis, you could reveal glimpses of the real historical and human Jesus. Meanwhile, two other Germans, Karl Heinrich Graf and Julius Wellhausen, developed what was to be called the four source hypothesis of Hebrew Scripture, mainly that the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, were cobbled together by editors, taking their material from four different sources over 1,000+ years. In other words, the Pentateuch was not written by Moses. Then came the bombshells from London. Darwin published The Origin of Species, and newly translated cuneiform tablets from Iraq suggested that the authors of Hebrew Scripture had plagiarized what we now know as the Epic of Gilgamesh. Oh man, the religious establishment went into a tailspin. In the United States, evolution and ancient clay tablets challenging the authority of the Bible and its inerrancy, the historical Jesus, and the four source hypothesis were seen by many as profound threats. Every effort was made to guard against their crossing the Atlantic. Nevertheless, they made their way across the pond via teachers like Charles Briggs at Union Theological Seminary and one of my heroes, Hinckley Mitchell at Boston University. So, through the 1890s, these modern ideas were creating major intellectual conflicts in American seminaries. People like Professor Mitchell were targeted by conservative forces and fired from their jobs. In 1909, gazillionaire founder of Union Oil, Lyman Stewart, and his brother Milton, anonymously paid for the writing of, printing, and mailing of 90 essays in 12 volumes called The Fundamentals, A Testimony to the Truth. Defending Orthodox Christian doctrine and attacking the new learnings from Europe, these volumes were mailed free of charge to ministers, missionaries, professors of theology, YMCA and YWCA secretaries, Sunday school superintendents, and other Protestant religious workers around the world. Over 3 million volumes were sent out. So, when 1910 rolled around, the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church was primed to adopt a 5-point declaration based on Union Oil's propaganda blitz. These 5 points, which all the candidates for ordination had to affirm, came to be known as the fundamentals. They included the inerrancy of the Bible, the virgin birth of Christ, Christ's substitutionary atonement, Christ's bodily resurrection, and the authenticity of Christ's miracles. Other denominations started adapting the 5 points, with point two often becoming the deity of Christ rather than the virgin birth, and the second coming replacing miracles. In other words, even the fundamentalists couldn't agree on what was fundamental, then or now. And in the midst of all this religious drama and the trauma of World War I, Harry Emerson Fosdick was receiving his seminary training, preaching at his first church, and serving as an army chaplain in France. After the war, the Presbyterians were tearing themselves apart, and because of his progressive views and to fend off fundamentalist influences, First Presbyterian in New York hired Fosdick as their preaching pastor. His theology resonated with many whose faith had been shaken by the social and theological upheavals of the early 20th century and the horrors of World War I. Fosdick's Christianity embraced social changes, scientific advances, and the new knowledge of biblical scholarship. Soon, capacity crowds packed the sanctuary every Sunday. The crowd often overflowed outside onto Fifth Avenue, where loudspeakers were set up so people could hear the sermon. And the more Fosdick preached, the more it became clear that the conventional Christian doctrines of the late 19th century Victorian world just didn't make sense anymore. It wasn't long before he felt called to address the elephant in the room. So, on May 21st, 1922, Fosdick preached what was essentially a plea for tolerance. Shall the fundamentalists win? Remember, the fundamentalists were putting clergy on trial and actively trying to drive people out who didn't believe the right things. So Fosdick acknowledged the gulf of disagreement between the modernists and the fundamentalists and wondered if there could ever be a church, quote, inclusive enough to take in both liberals and conservatives without either trying to drive the other out, unquote. Well, that's probably why his text that day is our Acts passage for today, where the conservative religious forces wanted to drag the apostles out and do away with them. But a wise leader stops them and says, hang on a second, let's just let them be and see what happens. You don't want to be opposed to them if what they're up to is of God. Fosdick basically said, look, I get it. The fundamentalists are scared. They see a great mass of new knowledge coming into humanity's possession and are afraid of the changes in the way people think and understand the world. Worse than that, the 19th Amendment had just passed, giving women the right to vote, a change that fundamentalists opposed on the biblical grounds that Eve was subservient to Adam. But despite the fundamentalist efforts to hold back time, Fosdick believed that one's faith and the modern world can't be kept in opposition to one another. He said, we must be able to think our modern life clear through in Christian terms, and to do that, we also must be able to think our Christian faith clear through in modern terms. His other main emphasis was on what he suggested was the sense of shame Christians should be feeling to be quarreling over what he perceived to be trifling matters of theology when the world was dying of great needs. He asks, if during the war, when the nations were wrestling upon the very brink of hell and at times all seemed lost, you chanced to hear two people in an altercation about some minor matter of sectarian denominationalism, could you restrain your indignation? You said, what can you do with folks like this who in the face of colossal issues, play with the tiddlywinks and peccadilloes of religion? I ask myself the same question today, and every poll indicates that this is the very reason why so many people have given up and abandoned religion altogether. When the world is in conflict and people's hopes and dreams are being crushed by prejudice, injustice, and greed, how is it that the church is still wasting its time arguing over the tiddlywinks and peccadilloes of religion? The simple answer is because the fundamentalists are still at work. They can't let go of the arcane and obsolete doctrines they've been clinging to for over 100 years, and they've brainwashed a lot of people. They so fervently believe they are doing God's will that they're willing to drive the whole Christian enterprise into a humiliating quagmire of kooky ideas, imposing their prejudices and purity codes on everybody else, no matter the human cost.
Well, why don't progressives just do what Gamaliel said and just let the fundamentalists be? Let God sort it out.
Because in the meantime, fundamentalists are hurting people. They're harming communities. They're institutionalizing prejudice. And they're misrepresenting Jesus. Who was most adamantly opposed to civil rights and the end of segregation in this country? Fundamentalist Christians. Who is behind most of the punitive and hateful anti-LGBTQ and anti-abortion laws passing through legislatures right now around the country? Fundamentalist Christians. The current effort to shut down teaching about racism and evolution in our schools is being driven by who? Fundamentalist Christians. If anyone tells you that religion is irrelevant today, they are not paying attention. Fundamentalist values and organizational skills are in the background of almost every single story you read on your news feed. So shall the fundamentalist win? They certainly seem to be. So here we are, 100 years later. The social conflicts may be a little different, but the theological ones are not. And just like 100 years ago, the fundamentalists are much better at getting their message out than the mainline church ever has been. And that's in part why we're recognizing this anniversary. David Pultz, archivist at First Presbyterian New York City, where Fosdick preached the sermon, says, "It's an important commemoration because it speaks to the heart of one's personal faith, the ability, the necessity to ask questions and to seek answers regarding how the Bible speaks to us today." That's really all Fosdick was asking. Are we as progressive Christians going to be allowed to ask questions and seek answers for today? Or are we going to be bulldozed or discredited in the name of true Christianity? Truth be told, the fundamentalists have done a great job over the last 100 years of infiltrating almost every corner of global Christianity. Over the last few years, every single mainline denomination has split, and we United Methodists are splitting as of today, precisely because none of our denominations have been able to fend off the influence of fundamentalists, throwing a wrench into the continued evolution of Christian thought. So, over the course of the next 4 weeks, we'll be looking at four of the doctrines fundamentalists are still promoting as necessary beliefs for true Christians. We'll be reflecting on whether or not progressively minded Christians have a relevant response, and we'll be asking ourselves still, shall the fundamentalists win? A bunch of years ago, I took my chainsaw into Lawn King in Phoenix. The chain had jumped the track and needed to be reset. The young guy at the counter tried to be nice in telling me it was hopeless, but the grizzled old guy at the bench in the back
looked up and croaked one word. Obsolete. No repair, I asked. Nope, he said. You might find some crazy person online who's stockpiled a bunch of parts, but short of that, it's worth nothing. I think that's what a lot of fundamentalists are afraid of, that as we try to think through our faith in modern terms, that we're just shouting obsolete and throwing the whole thing out. Granted, there are a lot of things that do need to be thrown out, but progressive Christianity is not just about deconstruction. It's about offering 21st century people a way of following Jesus that makes sense for today. One day, Fosdick went for a walk in Central Park with a young man who had heard him talk about progressive Christianity and was nervous about questioning the conventional faith of his childhood. As they walked and talked, they came upon a rectangular concrete reflecting pool. The water was still and peaceful, but much of it was choked with weeds. Breaking the silence, Fosdick commented to the young man, "Christianity is either like this pool, where you can stake it out, measure it, and control it, or it's like a river that has sprung up from a spring deep and unknowable. Its waters flow, dance, change, and added to by tributaries grows and changes course, always moving, often noisy, but never still, never stopping, and most certainly not moving backwards." Friends, don't believe the fundamentalists. Change is not Christianity's most deadly enemy. Stagnation is. Fosdick in his day and we in ours have the challenge of showing the world that Christianity is not a stagnant, weed-filled pond, but a dynamic, developing, and living faith. Sam Keen has written, "History is littered with the remains of civilizations that chose to die rather than change their organizing myth." What Fosdick knew then, and what we need to remember today, is that without a reevaluation of the organizing myths of Christianity, the church, too, is poised to pass into the irrelevance to which so many religions of the past have been relegated. My hope is that the next few weeks will help us all bolster our commitment to reevaluating some of the things we may have been taught in the past, look to reorganize ourselves, and take the steps necessary to be able to answer that 100-year-old question, shall the fundamentalists win, with a solid, "Not on my watch." Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.